Greetings to all you out there in podcast land. This is Adam Voigt, and you're listening to The Aristotle Project. The Aristotle Project works to bring back ancient wisdom for the modern world. We do have original thoughts and our own philosophy separate from Aristotle, but unless you understood Aristotle, you wouldn't understand anything we have to say that's original. So we created this so that you could catch up with us someday. But along the way, Aristotle is quite a roller coaster ride. So buckle up and we're on our way. In Book Gamma, Aristotle continues his metaphysical inquiry into looking at exactly what does the supreme science cover. What is the science of being? Is it a real thing? Do we really need it when we have natural science? What's it for? And he also looks at the fundamental presuppositions of his science as well as all sciences in general, and that no one can do without, and these also are the fundamental truths that no one can really doubt, and they're self-evident to everyone who understands them. So now let's continue. Every species of being will have a separate species of unity. So any science will study a different sort of being, and there's different sorts of beings besides molecules. But each sort of being will have its own kind of unity. So, for example, like numbers have their own kind of unity, words have their own kind of unity, molecules have their own kind of unity, but organisms have their own kind of unity as well. Yeah? And so you could study an organism and know, you can be the world's greatest expert on an organism and yet really not know anything about molecules. You know, you would simply study the organism at its level of unity, that level of unity that makes it an organism. Now, you could also study it as a bunch of molecules, but you're studying it qua chemist. You're not studying the organism qua organism, which is what a biologist would do. So if you're studying it qua chemist, well, then you're leaving something out. You know? And sometimes a biologist may want to be a chemist. You know, it's not irrelevant. Many biologists are very into chemistry and it's very helpful. That's because it's the next level down from what they're really focusing on, which is the organism. So the metaphysician is focused on something qua being. And what does this mean? He's looking at it in terms of, well, what sort of substance is it? What relation does it have to the primary sense of being? That is, of something which has matter, but it's not just matter, it also has a unity. It has some relation to a unified hunk of matter somewhere. That's not just a heap. That's the primary sense of being. Okay, so that's being and unity. So there's also contraries. Contraries are spoken of by most philosophers. So, like, for example, we had the limited and the unlimited of the Pythagoreans. Right? That's a contrary. And the unlimited was kind of like matter, and the limited was the form of that matter, or the rationality of numbers, the ratio of that matter, which limits it and makes it knowable, right? That's a contrary. So this every science studies the contraries that are within its field. But Aristotle says one of the contraries must be primary, and the other is a mere negation or a prime or a privation of that contrary. So Empedocles, who's one of my favorite early thinkers, thought that there was the cosmos, and then within the cosmos, what causes change are love and strife. And he thought both of them were equal. That love just like makes things collect together into unity, and strife takes those unities and splits them apart. They're opposite and equal. And he says they're perfectly equal in both, in every way, in his work. And Aristotle wants to contradict this and say, no, there must be, for every true contrary, there must be something that's primary. Aristotle says love is primary, and that hate or strife are just secondary, that they just split up. And this is for the same reason that unity and being are the same. Unity is primary. If unity is primary, then love is primary. And strife must be secondary. It just must be a privation. And when we study what is, we want to study unity as opposed to disunity. So that's what he says. And then there's other words that we'll throw in there. And so the science of unity must also study plurality and difference, otherness, dissimilarity, inequality, contrariety, and among the contraries, there's negation and privation. Any of these words can be used in various senses, but as long as there's one primary sense that they point to, they're all used in one science. And so, like what's an example of this? An example of this is my favorite example is years ago, it was discovered that there was a group of mushrooms in Oregon. And they took DNA samples from these mushrooms, and they found that they were all pretty much genetically related to each other in precisely the same way as if you took DNA samples from your toenail and your finger and your brain and, you know, the lining of your mouth and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So they thought that was really curious. So then they did studies and they found out that these mushrooms were all connected underground. And they're all basically, and there's other creatures that have been found that are like this, that seem like one creature when you look at them in the micro level. But then, macroscopically, they look different. Like there's a bunch of trees. Like sometimes certain trees will connect underground via the roots, and they'll look like separate trees. Mm-hmm. And then there's colonial organisms in the ocean, like big jellyfish and other weird creatures that I don't even know the names of, but I think there's one called the siphonophore, I read about it in a book once. That's a big colonial organism, and it's hard to know, well, is this one creature or not? Mm-hmm. Right? And so biologists have sort of like debated among each other, well, is this one creature or is it not? So the biological ontologist who looks at things from the highest level, what would they say? What do you think they would say? What questions would you ask? You don't have to give them an answer, but you could say, well, the answer to whether all these mushrooms are really one organism would depend on this. And if you could find out the answer to this question, then maybe that would tell you if it was one organism. Do you think you have an answer for them?
An answer for them?
Yeah, like what's the, what would mean that all those mushrooms are one organism?
That they were born separate, probably.
They were born separate. So like, well, your cells were born separate. Like you started out as one cell, and then that cell split into two, and then those two cells split into four, and they kept on. So all your cells are descended from one common ancestor. But how do all these cells in your body that are descended from one common ancestor, your zygote, how are they all part of the same organism? And how are they all different? And how does that relate to these mushrooms in Oregon? Or perhaps we should just call it the great mushroom of Oregon, you know, that takes up, you know, 20 or 30 miles, I think.
Jeez.
Yeah, it stretches underground. There's mycelia, which are like roots for mushrooms. And it turns out that mushrooms are not the organism. They're just the flowers that come up above ground. The real organism is underground. So, I know this is a really hard question. Actually, I completely expected you to be totally stumped by this. It's not really a fair question. But I wanted to give you a chance to answer it.
Organisms for like each thing, don't they?
For each what? For each mushroom?
Yeah.
Well, like I said, the mushrooms are flowers.
Do you want me to call the whole mushroom then?
The what?
What do you want me to call the whole mushroom then?
Well, just like what we call the whole flower. We call it a flower. I have books of field guides to flowers upstairs, and it's the guide to the entire plant. They don't just look at the flowers. They look at the stem, the leaves, the roots, the whole deal.
Yeah, well, the whole flower, yeah. Plant, fungi, thingy.
So.
Wait, how does that work?
The whole, so is, but like, is there only one organism for the mushroom organism for the whole planet, or maybe just for North America? How do you distinguish between one fungal organism and another?
There'll be like multiple like systems.
Multiple systems. See, now you're thinking.
Trying to get across.
That's good. See, well, that's actually true. That's actually Aristotle's answer. Or if I understand you correctly, is that each organism is a system. And what's a system? A system, it's a very difficult thing to say what a system is. I mean, there's a
system is like the whole body trying to like live for itself, how it does things.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's true. It does try to live for itself, although what itself is difficult to say. But it does have something about it that it's living for, and that it's a collection of things that all serve that purpose in different ways, right? And that if any of those parts are missing, then the function doesn't get served. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, so that is basically, I mean, we're at a real, you just randomly, of course I've led you along, but you know, you on your own have come up with this, one of the key parts of the definition of substance for Aristotle. Aristotle, being a biologist rather than a mathematician, has a different concept of substance. And it's a substance of a system. Of a system that has parts that are unified and are required for something. We don't know what yet, but it certainly is required for something. So that's the unity. That's why if you chop a human in half, you don't get two humans, because a human is a whole system. And that other half of that human is not arbitrarily, it's not redundant. It's needed. And if you don't have it, you don't have a human. But what about the mushrooms? What if you built a wall underground between this half of mushroom, let's call it Mushroomia, the country of this one mushroom, right? Let's say you built a wall underground and divided this half of the mushroom land.
Wait, would you mean cut them off? Because if they're underground, then I don't think they're affected by each other. Or this random wall.
No, but if you built it underground.
Yeah, so do you want to cut them off?
Yeah, so that the mycelia underground couldn't contact each other. Now, if they would die, then...
That might be how they, like, spread, or away they spread.
That's true, they do spread that way. Well, they also spread by wind.
Well, yeah, like other mushrooms.
Yeah, the mushrooms pop up above the ground and are shaped the way they are so that they can drop little motes of dust, which are called spores, and then the wind will carry them. So that's...
So they might be a little, like, themselves.
Well, if they can't reroute, and if they can't reconnect, then do they die?
Yeah, I'm saying they could be able to, like, reroute by themselves.
Yeah. If they couldn't, they wouldn't die. They would just go on. Actually, we don't know that for sure. I'm assuming that if you cut a clonal forest or a clonal mycelial network, which is what we're talking about with the mushrooms, I'm assuming if you cut them in half, then the other half wouldn't care. They'd be totally cool. They'd be like, whatever. You know, they wouldn't even know that it happened. They would just go on doing their thing. Mm-hmm. And they don't need that other half of the fungal province or fungal county, whatever, however big that fungal network is. They don't need it. It's not a unified organism in the same way that a human is or that a bacteria is. Like if you take a single cell and you chop it in half, it's not going to survive. It's a complete substance. Now, if that substance divides on its own, then it's going to be fine because that's what it's meant to do right from its very core, right? But that's different from coming in and surprising it and being like, aha, chopping that bacterium in half, right? That's totally different. Okay, so now I have another question. We seem to have an answer.
No,
we don't have an answer as to what an organism is. Well, our answer was that this mushroom country that we were talking about, this mycelial network, is not a single organism. That it's kind of like a collection of many, 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 many organisms. Kind of like a glass of water, right? And that really, the glass of water is not a entity that the scientists would study.
Well, I mean, if you cut a glass in half, it would break. Kind of just two pieces of fancy glass.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Well, but you're not studying glasses, you're studying water, right? Yeah. I mean, if you're studying glasses, then, you know, that's a whole other thing. You're true. You're right. The glass itself has a substantial unity to it. But the water contained in it, it receives that unity. Whatever unity it has, and it's not much, it's not substantial unity, it gets from just being in the glass. It doesn't get as a result of itself. So, it's accidental to the water, but it's essential to the glass. You know what I'm saying? So that's, okay, so the answer about the mushrooms is that, and it's not just mushrooms, there's many organisms in nature where you have a vast network of interconnected and genetically similar elements that are not a single organism. It's in plants, it's in fungi, it's in animals, you know, in certain circumstances. And trying to think, like the amoebic sea. Mm-hmm. Like if a biologist lands on Darwin 4, this alien planet, right, that we've watched on YouTube just for the audience. If a biologist lands on this planet and sees this big amoebic sea and it's alive, this big ocean that eats things that fly over it, right? How does it know whether it's a single organism or not? You couldn't take DNA or whatever passes for DNA. You couldn't sequence its genome from different parts of the shore. Like you couldn't walk to the opposite side of it, sequence it, and then say, oh, look, it's the same DNA. Therefore, it's the same organism. You couldn't say that. Yeah, they might not. Or it might be universal. That's an empirical question. We don't know. But you could sequence it, whatever it is. And if it was genetically similar, that's not enough. That's not enough to make it a single organism, according to our definition. It has to be a system. So like if you built a dam, or you, like, say you dug out another sea on the other side of Darwin 4, and then you somehow levitated or carried half the amoebic sea to that place, would the rest of the amoebic sea die? Or would it just, gradually recover? And
probably just sink further down, just be a shallow lake, you think?
But it would grow to fill that sea again, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, maybe it wouldn't. Maybe it would just die. If maybe it did die,
the amoebic sea will expand and populate.
Yeah. Well, it'd be an expensive experiment to run, that's for sure. Because it's big. It's like the size of Texas, right?
So it's like not even here.
Yeah. You'd have to get there
getting
first.
Getting there is already all the money.
Well, what you'd want to do is you would take a little bit of it. I mean, realistically, you take a teeny tiny amount. It's kind of like scraping a little bit of skin off you and then trying to clone it. You know, and obviously that's not going to harm you. But, if you scraped enough skin, then it would harm you. It's kind of like a vague thing. But if you just chopped off a whole limb, well, then that would definitely harm you. So, like, you would...
scraping off skin, depends if it's, like, dead skin or not, but, like, it's going to harm you, just not much.
Yeah, it's true. So it's not an either-or proposition. But this is, I think, the important thing about our current conversation is that it tells you the sorts of things that an ontologist could tell a special scientist. So in this case, the special science is biology, and the general science is ontology. So an ontologist has a distinct sort of study, right? And this field of study is being qua being. But the biologist doesn't specialize in that. He just specializes in living things. So if a biologist is wondering, is this really a substance or not? Is this really its own thing, or is it just a big mishmash, a big soup or heap of other things, which are themselves real substances? Then the biologist would have to ask an ontologist, a philosopher, or a first philosopher, as Aristotle calls it. And in fact, biologists have asked this question of ontologists. And I don't know what the final answer is. I've just sort of skimmed through the literature, right? But this, I think, what we've just been talking about colonial organisms and these large networks of mycelia or roots or other things like that, I think that this illustrates that there is a distinct field of study called ontology or first philosophy, and that it's distinct from biology and mathematics and the other special sciences, and that it's also above it, because the biologist assumes a certain set of assumptions to even get going. It assumes that there are organisms that have unity, that are systems, and that these systems have certain requirements, and that the unity is of a certain kind.
Well, if you started biology, or if they started biology, and they were just like, oh shoot, there's no organisms, they're going to realize that after they make an assumption.
Oh yeah, well then, if the assumptions that they make find that there are nothing that fit the assumption, then they'll either stop that field of study and say we're studying nothing, or they will change their assumptions. And it has been the case that some scientists have changed their assumptions. And this is called a paradigm shift. So like when Darwin published his work, it caused biologists to change their assumptions about what an organism was. But just they only changed a few of them. most of their assumptions were still correct. And people, you know, people kept on doing, you know, the same people were still experts in the field before and after Darwin, because most of what they knew was correct. Now, and that's the same is true of astrophysics, you know, and physics in general. Some sciences have radically changed their assumptions about what, how they defined what a planet was and what a star was and what's matter and what's energy. They've really radically changed these, but yet most of what they've assumed from the get-go was correct. And it's just when they took their assumptions that they started with and kept on holding them constant and extrapolating from them, they eventually reached a point
they
where
they... used to think the Earth was flat and the center of the galaxy is filled with water.
Yeah, but they knew that the Earth was here and that there were planets up there and stars up there.
Okay, that's not much though.
Yeah, and that some of the stars moved and those were called planets, and other stars only moved like this way, all together. And the planets move by themselves in certain regular. So those assumptions were correct. And so that's the, but like others were incorrect, obviously. So the, that's kind of, okay, so that's basically it. That's what, and every time that scientists went through a paradigm shift or changed their assumptions about what it is that they were talking about, that's a time when philosophers had something to say about it and were part of the conversation. They didn't boss around the special scientist and command them to believe certain things because philosophy says this. But at the same time, philosophers were part of the conversation that biologists and everyone was having about, like, wow, gosh, does the sun move? Or are we descended from apes or something like that? Philosophy is always part of the conversation at that time. And I think that we'll see that just because philosophy is a supreme science and rules over whatever that means, biology and physics, it doesn't mean that the philosopher bosses everybody around and knows more about stuff than they do. It just means that philosophy is here to study everything and has something to say about anything. But it doesn't mean that it's an expert on everything. And this is, I think, and I think it'll become clear, this is what Aristotle is arguing for, a very modest sort of ruling supreme science that doesn't boss everybody around. And it's kind of like how a government should be. Governments should let all their people, even though they rule them, it should let them just live their lives how they want, you know? And Aristotle is much more, his politics are much more constitutional in that way. And that the ruler should rule constitutionally according to the rule of law. Whereas other philosophers think, no, the ruler should just be in charge. People would just go crazy. You got to boss everybody around all the time. But, and Aristotle thinks that philosophy should rule in exactly this sort of way, I think. And anyway, but it does rule. According to him, it is a supreme science, and it, in a sense, knows everything to the extent that you could know everything. And how, what that extent is, we still don't know yet. But I think we've got, in our discussion of the country of the mushrooms, and the underground networks of identical mushrooms, right? I think we've got an understanding of a sample question of how a philosopher could contribute to something. Anyway. And I hope that makes sense. And I think the next time we're going to come back and we're going to look at something which is pretty interesting. And it's a paradox of knowledge where if there is a science of everything, a science of being qua being, what are the axioms of this science? And if Aristotle's right, these axioms of this supreme science should be those truths which are absolutely impossible to doubt and which you cannot get by without, and that are presupposed by every other science ever, and which cannot be known by these sciences, qua those sciences, but which must be assumed in order to get started. And these are the three laws of thought. And they are truths which are so supreme and so true that they cannot be doubted. Although many have tried.
Studying three laws of thought would be the supreme science?
It's a big part of it. It's the starting point for the supreme science. So we're going to get there next time. And it's going to be one of the more interesting episodes. It's going to be crazy. Because these three laws of thought are so wacko. They're wacko. And we'll compare them to other supposedly indubitable truths that modern people have come up with. And we'll show that really modern supreme truths are just pathetic. Okay. So thanks for helping me out this time, Ada. That was a really good conversation. And I hope you'll all join me for the next one, which will be on the three laws of thought.
Yay.
See you next time.
Bye.
All right.
I'm tired. Awesome cat's gonna die, I think.
Oh. All right, here we go. Stop.